Good morning, and welcome to another in our series, the Medical Ethics, Medical Halacha series. I want to thank the Bayit Adult Education, and in particular Geneso for their help in making this possible. I will ask people to please make sure that they sign in, especially if you want to have CME credit for it, but in general so I can follow up on anything that comes up during the class that I'm not able to address in the session itself. If I already have your email address, as in you already received notifications for this class, you don't need to write in your email address. Also, you should have received, those who are doing this for CME, should have received letters this past week by email for confirming your credits for 2017. If you didn't receive a letter and you were supposed to receive one, please let me know. If you received one and there's a mistake in it, please let me know. Okay, thank you. And last note, in introduction, if you could please silence cell phones, I would greatly appreciate it. Thank you. Okay. So, I received an anonymous dedication for the class this morning. Our topic is aiding an abortion. So somebody wishes to sponsor the class in honor of the women who have not had access to traditional guidance when facing an abortion. With that in mind, nothing that I say this morning should be taken as construing guidance. I am going to speak about the issues. I'm going to quote sources, including sources that speak practically on particular cases. But really, nothing I say should be taken as in any way, shape, or form psak, a halachic ruling. This is the sort of area which demands that one consult not only with doctors, but also with rabbis in order to get guidance. I brought you a couple of sources in the very beginning of the source sheet that reflect that. Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, a rabbi in Israel at Har Bracha, has a halachic series of books called Dinei Halacha, which is extremely valuable and well worth reading. And it's available online, so you know, what more could you ask for? Take a look at what he has to say in source number one. He says, even when the couple, even though I brought you the Hebrew for the sources on the page, I'm going to stick with the English in the interest of time, but you'll be able to see both. He says, even when the couple has decided to follow the view permitting abortion, it would be appropriate for them to take counsel with a rabbi who deals with these issues. And has been stated, they may choose a rabbi whose inclination is to be lenient in these matters. Which is a very interesting parenthetical note that he just throws in there. But he says, to pick a rabbi who deals with these issues. First, to verify that the medical opinion is trustworthy. We're going to talk about that later. Second, because one cannot be lenient without responsible weighing of the issue. For the law is established based upon many factors, such as fetal age, the type of illness, the form of abortion, the quality of the test, and the family situation. Further, the decision regarding abortion is very difficult in hidden ways for the couple, and taking counsel with a trained rabbi will ease these hidden issues and guide them on a good path to continue building their family. There are so many sensitive issues, both on the halachic side and on the personal side, that you really need the counsel of somebody who knows what they're talking about, somebody who knows what they're doing. And I emphasize where he says, a rabbi who deals with these issues, somebody who has experience in this field. This is all extremely important, and so I stress that at the outset. Other notes that I think is really important to see is from source number two, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who wrote an article, as you see here in the tradition in 1991, called Abortion, a Halachic Perspective. He cites this article liberally throughout the sources, first of all, because Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein is always very good, and second, because he wrote it in English, and therefore I didn't have to translate it. So for both reasons. He says, the reader, this comes at the end of his article. He says, the reader has surely discerned that in a number of places I have refrained from setting down definitive conclusions, but have been satisfied to indicate general principles, tendencies, and possibilities in the halacha. This approach is not merely the product of modesty or hesitation in resolving debates among halachic titans. It is rooted in a view of the nature of psak in general and regarding this topic specifically. These are areas where, on the one hand, the halachic details are not clearly fleshed out in the Talmud and Rishonim, the early authorities, and on the other hand, the personal circumstances are often complex and perplexing. In such areas, there is room, and in my opinion, an obligation for a measure of flexibility. A sensitive posek, halachic authority, recognizes both the gravity of the personal situation and the seriousness of the halachic factors. He goes on to say, this approach is neither evasive nor discriminatory, meaning saying that you're going to give one answer in one situation, another answer in another situation. The flexibility arises from a recognition that halachic rulings are not and should not be the output of human microcomputers, but of thinking human beings. A recognition that these rulings must be applied to concrete situations with a bold effort to achieve the optimal moral and halachic balance among the various factors. Thus, it is the case that halachic rulings have more of the character of general directives than specific decisive rulings, within set limits, of course, and when the posek is not absolutely convinced respecting the point at issue, the point is that if you're going to set down rules in discussing abortion, the rules are not going to speak to specific cases, but rather will be general guidance that needs to be applied to the case at hand with a careful eye and with a very with a lot of care for the specifics of the situation. So I wanted to stress at the outset that anybody who actually is dealing with this needs a specialist. And a specialist in terms of the halacha, and somebody who's going to speak to the case at hand, as opposed to overarching overarching principles. I'm not going to bring every possible source and every possible point of conflict in this discussion. We have 90 minutes, not 90 hours. I did bring in source number 3 links for past classes that I've given here, which might be relevant for people. It might be worth a listen. The first one on the issue of genetic screening, and the issue of aborting before implanting, right, in a case like PGD, where a zygote is formed, an embryo is formed, and then they decide that they don't, whether we're talking about they have multiple that have been produced and they're only going to implant certain ones, or whether a problem is detected and they don't want to implant. Or second, very interesting case, but again, beyond the scope of what we'll get to this morning, the issue of chemotherapy during a pregnancy, where you have double effect issues and issues of one life versus another. That's also beyond the scope of what we're going to get to this morning. So here's what we will get to, after disclaimers about the others. The following four cases. Sarah is in. It's in source number 4. You know what? Maybe I'll say them outside of the actual example, just in the interest of time, and we're going to come back to them as we deal with them one by one. The first case is a relatively straightforward one. It's the case of a diagnosis that a fetus has Tay-Sachs at the 11th week of pregnancy, which, you know, is a normal time for it if you're diagnosing via CVS. That's the one particular method. So the question of, if the couple feels they can't deal with that, are they allowed to abort at that stage? The second one is dealing with a woman who has experienced moderate to severe postpartum depression with past pregnancies. She was not trying to become pregnant again. It happened anyway. And now the question is, are they allowed to abort to avoid a recurrence, a potential recurrence of that postpartum depression? The third one is a discussion of the Plan B pill, a pill which, according to the literature, doesn't abort, but rather prevents conception. And so that's an interesting question. Is one able to use that? And then if not, could one use RU486, the abortion pill, which has a longer period of time? And then the last one is the one that gives the class its title in terms of aiding an abortion, and that's the issue of an anesthesiologist who works in a hospital and is instructed to provide IV sedation during an abortion, where it's one that halacha would not approve. So those are our topics for our 90 minutes. Hopefully we'll get to all of them. We're going to do the best we can. But in order to address this, we have to start out with a basic question, which is, how does the Torah view the act of abortion? What is the Torah's perspective in general on abortion? And it's very clear. It looks like I probably don't have enough sheets for everybody, so if people are able to share as they can, I do plan to send out the follow-up email later. I'll send out the digital version of the source sheets as well. If you take a look at source number 5, I brought you a quote from the Rambam just to show that, yes, on a very basic level, killing a fetus is indeed prohibited. The Rambam writes, he's quoting from the Gemara, the Torah prohibits having mercy for the life of a pursuer. If one person is endangering the life of another, then the rule is that you're not allowed to have mercy on the pursuer, the one who's trying to harm somebody else. Therefore, the sages ruled that one may cut the fetus inside a woman who is having difficulty giving birth, whether through medicine or by hand, whether one aborts with medicine or by hand, as though he was pursuing her to kill her. Of course, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's not trying to. But if he is endangering the mother, then one aborts. And then he continues to say, once he produces his head, that's a different story. But I want to focus on the first part of what he said here. What do we deduce from the fact that the Rambam says that if he's endangering the mother, then we abort? What does that teach me about a fetus in general? Sorry?
That if he's not endangering, we don't abort.
That he's not, right. If he's not presenting a threat, then we do not abort. This is probably a good time for me to reiterate, since a lot of people came in after my announcement, to please make sure to silence cell phones. This it tells me right off the bat that we're not allowed to abort normally. However, what is not clear and requires some conversation is what law is being violated when an abortion takes place. And the challenge is that the Torah does not state clearly at what point a fetus becomes a full life, and at what point and in what way one would be prohibited from ending its life. The evidence, in fact, goes in multiple directions. If anyone ever tells you it's clear-cut, they're not talking about Judaism. That's a rule in any topic. That's not just about abortion. But it's certainly true when we talk about abortion. Take a look at source number 6. Here we have the Torah's statement, Makeh ish vameis mos yumas, one who strikes an ish, who then dies, will be put to death. Right, that's for the act of murder, for striking and killing an ish. But I don't know the meaning of the word ish. Right? You could translate ish to be man. Right? Does that mean if one strikes a woman, then there is no death penalty? No, that's not true. Please be careful. This is recorded. That is not true. So I need to define what exactly ish is. If you take a look at source number 7, things really get complicated. This is a law regarding men who are fighting and accidentally strike a pregnant woman. The Torah says, when men fight and they strike a pregnant woman and her children emerge, but there is no death, meaning for her, he, the man who struck her, shall be punished as established upon him by the woman's husband, and he shall pay it in court. And if there is death, you shall give a life for a life. What does this teach me about the life of a fetus? Not equivalent to the life of somebody who is walking around on two legs, who's right in the extra uterine. Thanks, that's what I wanted to say. Somebody's already made it out of the uterus. How do I know that from this text?
Because there's no death penalty.
There's no death penalty, and you're paying something, right? The general rule is that if one murders somebody else, the punishment is the death penalty, and there is no such thing as paying for damages. Damages are limited to a case of wounding somebody. They don't apply in a case of killing somebody. Yeah?
Just the hobby, of course, the church's interpretation leaves out that parenthetical statement.
Leaves out the parenthetical statement that...
if there's no death for her.
Oh, the death for her. Correct.
Church interprets
that
there's no death.
Okay, yeah, no, that's true. I'm not beholden to Augustine. This is true.
Sorry, so just to clarify, it means the fetus has died?
Yes, correct. It means they emerged and died. That's correct. Worth noting that it says he pays based on what is established by the woman's husband. This is a basic principle that paternity comes with responsibility and therefore with a right. Meaning, the father of the children is responsible for their financial well-being. He has to support them. And therefore, that which they earn as minors is also his property. And therefore, as crass as it sounds in this particular situation, the father of the children is the one who will claim the damages, even though the mother is the one who was pregnant. So much so that actually Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who we'll discuss later, is one of the most prominent lenient voices regarding abortion, is still of the view that the father has to give permission because of this point that he has the financial responsibility, his rights over the child.
What happens if a woman accidentally pushes or whatever?
Same rule.
He shall also.
Correct. Yes.
What happens if it was the husband?
If it was the husband that did it, then he will have to pay him. I mean, the payment will be moot. That's what it would mean.
So like there's no payment.
There's no payment to be made. That doesn't mean it was permissible. I go back to the Rambam, but it means that the payment issue is void. There's no.
Because it sort of suggests that there's no payment. As if it's not a real crime.
Right. And that's, again, we're going to have to come back to what exactly is the crime that's involved. It's not covered by this verse. That's correct.
What about the other payments that the woman is entitled to? Bloodshed and pain.
Right. So in the event that the woman is wounded, then there will be other payments that would have to go to her. Anytime somebody injures a party, not murders, but injures a party, then there is payment that goes to that party in five different categories. Nezek, Tzar, Ripui, Sheves, and Boshes. One pays for damages, one pays for time lost from work, one pays for pain, one pays for humiliation, one pays for medical bills. There are all sorts of payments to be made. That's not in the context here, because here they're talking about the injury to the fetus specifically, as opposed to the injury to her. Elsewhere, the Torah discusses injury to someone who is extrauterine. Thank you for the term. So what we see here is that the fetus is not the equivalent of the person who has already been born, but I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means. All I know is there's no death penalty. That doesn't mean that this is okay. So what exactly is this? Well, the Talmud itself is also unclear. I'm going to show you sources that go both ways. If you take a look at source number 8, the following source and the one after it seem to indicate that the fetus is considered to be a full life. The first one in number 8 is the source for what Maimonides said in number 5, that if a woman is having trouble giving birth, having trouble doesn't just mean the labor is difficult, it means that she is actually endangered. So then we cut the fetus in her womb, and we produce it limb by limb. Her life precedes that of the fetus. So this seems to indicate that normally I'm not allowed to kill it, right? At least at this stage in the pregnancy, when she's trying to give birth. However, you could argue maybe it's only at this stage, at the end of the pregnancy. The next one, regarding Shabbos, source number 9. If a woman is on the birthing table and she dies, and it is Shabbos, they bring a knife, meaning even without an Eruv, you're bringing it through a public domain, and you tear open her belly and produce the child. We break Shabbos in order to save the life of the fetus. Normally, that's what you do for a full living human being. So that would seem to indicate it has full living human being status. On the other hand, you could make the argument the other way. And you could say maybe that's because the mother has already passed on. And therefore the fetus is no longer dependent on the mother. Now it has become as though it were extrauterine. It's as though it had already been born. It's just inside of the body of what had been its mother. Julie.
Well, in this case also the mother is rodefet, no? Because a dead mother is dangerous to a living fetus.
Well, that's an interesting formulation. That's an interesting formulation. You're now saving the fetus from the rodef. However, from the rodefet, correct. Let's be grammatically correct. But I would suggest that if it's not considered a full life, that still won't warrant violating Shabbos. Right? That still won't help me. So these sources could be read to suggest it's considered to be a full life. However, you have sources that go the other way. The most famous one is what I brought you in source number 10, which I'm going to say outside of the text rather than go into the nuances of eating truma. And that is what you see at the end of the source, that a fetus is considered to be mere water until 40 days have elapsed. Now, in the context there, they're talking about whether I guess they do have to go into it a little bit, whether a fetus of a Kohen, born from a Kohen, is also considered a Kohen, such that his mother is able to eat truma because she has she's carrying it. Well, that's a longer story. Never mind. But the point is whether the fetus is considered to be a full blown life, and we're saying that until 40 days it doesn't have full status. That may mean that after 40 days it does, but at least until 40 days there's some question. The next source that I bring takes us back to number 8. And that is the second line in number 8, where we say once the majority of the fetus has emerged, we don't touch it because we don't push away one life for another. Ein docha nefesh mipnei nefesh. So what does that tell me its status was until then? Less than a nefesh, right? It was less than a nefesh until that stage. It was called chayim. Right, we use the phrase in the Hebrew chayeha kodmin lechayav, her life precedes its life, but the word nefesh is only used once it emerges, and nefesh is a term that we associate with life.
What's a nefesh?
Sorry?
What is a nefesh,
source 12? We're not there yet. We're getting there. If you take a look at source number 11, another source that casts doubt on the status before the child is born, it talks about, this is a Mishnah that talks about the laws of children, and it says, Tinok ben yom echad, a child who is a day old has various laws, including, Vahorgo chayav, one who kills it is liable. Implying, only from that point forward. Although you could make the argument that there is liability for what happens beforehand, just not the death penalty. Maybe for technical reasons, there's no death penalty until then. And you can come up with all sorts of technical reasons not to give the death penalty to a fetus. Right? For example, you don't know for sure that it was going to be born and be viable. So maybe it is in fact murder, but we're not able to carry out a death penalty for it. Another example of this is source number 12. Source number 12 points to the verses that we use regarding capital punishment for murder. So it says, the Torah needed to say, one who strikes an ish. Right? This is the verse that we saw back in number 6. The Torah needed to say, one who strikes an ish and kills him. And so on. And it also needed a separate verse which says, any who strike a nefesh and kill it will be put to death. For had the Torah said, one who strikes an ish and he dies, if it had only said that, I might have said that for an ish who is obligated in mitzvot, this is the law, but not for a minor. I might have said ish means adult, as opposed to minor. If you only had the verse in source number 6, one who strikes an ish who then dies will be put to death, I might have said that's only if you kill an adult. Therefore, the Torah wrote, any who strike a nefesh. And nefesh is any life, not just an adult. And had the Torah written, any who strike a nefesh, if the Torah only gave me that verse, I might have thought this included a nephel, or an 8-month fetus. A nephel is what? A non-viable baby. A baby who cannot make it to 30 days because of some health issue. Right? That's the case of an nephel, or an 8-month fetus. An 8-month fetus is way beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about, except to say that going back to the times of the Talmud, there was an understanding that a fetus born after 8 months of gestation would not survive. And there are all sorts of theories as to what they're talking about. Is it because we're talking about a fetus that needed longer and this was premature as a birth? We know that fetuses can be born earlier and survive, and did in the days of the Talmud. They talk about a fetus being born after 7 months and surviving. So why they say this for the 8th month, I think we actually discussed it in a previous class at some point, but it's not going to be our discussion right now. Right now, what I'm noting for you is, when the Talmud says 8-month fetus, what it means is a fetus which is born which is not viable. That's really what you should substitute in your head for 8-month fetus. And what he's saying is, what the Talmud here is saying is, had the Torah written, any who strike a nefesh and kill it are put to death, I might have thought that included the non-viable fetus, nephel, or the one born after 8 months. Therefore, both texts are necessary. So what's in...
Yeah.
No, at 8 months. Before 8 months? After 8 months.
After 8 months is everybody.
No, meaning in the 8th month. Let me phrase it that way. In the 8th month. Thank you. So...
2 weeks.
Sorry?
32 weeks.
Yes, 32 to 36. Or 32 to 35 in 6 days is the 8th month. And then after that, you start your 9th month. I'm being imprecise, which I understand, but that's that. Just I don't want to get dragged into the whole 8-month fetus discussion because there's a whole other discussion about halacha and modern medicine. The point here and what emerges here is that they take these two verses that speak about murder and the fact that one specifies ish and one specifies nefesh. And they deduce that had you said any who strike a nefesh, I would have thought that there would be a liability for murder for killing this 8-month fetus. And there isn't liability for murder for killing an 8-month fetus. And that tells me, once again, that maybe a fetus is not a full life. To which you could respond, though, that's only the case of the 8-month fetus, which is not viable. It doesn't apply necessarily to a fetus that's already been born into the to a fetus that is viable. The next source is the most difficult of Talmudic sources on this, and I don't pretend that this is straightforward. Difficult not in the sense that it's hard to understand, but difficult in the sense that it's hard to understand. And you'll see what I mean as you read it. This is talking about the case of capital punishment and a woman who is going to be executed. I don't have time now to do a full preface on capital punishment and the difficulty of carrying it out and so on. Suffice it to say, the Torah does not want us carrying out capital punishment. It is generally meant as a deterrent, but it is a law on the books. So the Mishnah says the following. We do not delay a woman's execution until she gives birth. So if a woman is subject to the death penalty and she's pregnant, they execute her anyway. Once she sits on the birthing table, if, however, she is already in labor, we wait for the birth. Says the Gemara commenting on this Mishnah, Rav Yehuda said, quoted Shmuel, if a woman is going to be executed, we strike near her womb so that the fetus will die first, so that she will not be disgraced, meaning, as Rashi explains, should the baby emerge after her death. Okay. Sorry?
Is this a post-mortem fetal excursion?
Yes. I believe it. So the question here is, you're telling me that that we don't delay her execution until she gives birth. What does that tell me about the status of a fetus? It's not an independent life. Right? That's what that would seem to be the indication.
There is a head of complication that typically involves executing on the day of the sentence.
Correct. Correct. As the Gemara clarifies, and Harold points out correctly, we have a rule called Inui Hadin. You don't want to cause the person who's going to be executed to suffer, and therefore, as a general rule, you require that they not sit there anticipating their death. They're executed on the day when the verdict finally comes down. You don't make them wait longer for it to be carried out, and so this is considered to be a kindness to the mother, that she is going to be executed and not have to wait. And yes, as I said, this is hard to understand psychologically. I'm not so sure about what the mother's psychology is going to be in this situation. Nonetheless, that's the point of bringing this, is to say that if we viewed the fetus as a full-blown life, it would be hard to understand, number one, the fact that we're going to execute her with the fetus inside, and number two, that we would actually kill the fetus before her just that she won't be disgraced. Now, I brought you Rashi's note, should the baby emerge after her death, but there's a separate line in Rashi which I should have brought as well. Basically, the suggestion is that it's because the fetus has a death sentence as well as being part of the mother. And maybe that's the justification. Last Talmudic source on this is source number 14. Source number 14 is a very important source in this conversation. It speaks about the law for the vast majority of humanity, right? People who are not Jewish. And they say the following here. They quoted Rabbi Yishmael as saying, a Noahide is liable even for killing a fetus. Meaning, one of the seven mitzvot that apply to all human beings is the prohibition against murder. And the Talmud says, for a non-Jew, that applies even for killing a fetus. Now, right off the bat, that seems to say that for a Jew, it does not apply, right? Otherwise, it would be under the general prohibition for Jews as well. We're going to see the rest of this source now because it's going to matter in a little bit. Why? The Talmud asks, why is it that they are liable? Because the Torah says, one who spills the blood of man in man, his blood will be spilled. So this is not the conventional way to read that text. The text in Hebrew normally goes, Shofech dam ha'adam, ba'adam damo yishafech. One who spills the blood of a person, by a person, his blood will be spilled. Meaning human beings are responsible to carry out the execution of the murderer. However, reading this another way, because the Talmud is bothered, because you don't need to say ba'adam damo yishafech, right? Remember what drash is, what medrash is. It is a sensitive ear to biblical text that picks up on nuances that people normally miss. In this case, why did you need to tell me ba'adam damo yishafech? By man his blood shall be spilled. Normally when the Torah says things like mot yumat, right, that someone will be put to death, it doesn't say by man. We just understand that's what it's telling you is to execute. So the word is superfluous. And that's what the Talmud is picking up on. And it's reading it as one who spills the blood of man in man, the blood of a person inside another person, as in a fetus inside its mother, damo yishafech, his blood will be spilled. That's the idea. And then there's another sage who disagreed with it, who disagreed apparently with Rabbi Yishmael's idea, who said, no, read the text the way that we normally read the text. One who spills the blood of man, in man his blood will be spilled. That's the normal way to read it. So the point of this text is twofold. Number one, it's telling me that non-Jews have a mitzvah of not killing not only people, but also a fetus. Whereas Jews may not, indicating again that the fetus is not considered to be a full life. And number two, it's telling me you should know that for non-Jews, there is indeed such a prohibition, which may not apply, we'll have to see, which may not apply to Jews. So what emerges, hopefully, from what we've seen so far, is that the biblical text, as well as the Mishnah and the Gemara, are conflicted in terms of what they're presenting to us about the nature of a fetus. Is it a full-blown life? Is killing it murder or not? Julie.
If a Gentile has a different din on abortion, does that mean a Jewish woman could have an abortion done by a non-Jewish doctor and that's a different opinion than having a Jewish doctor, or it would not be permitted with a Jewish
doctor? So we will come back to that, God willing, and the answer essentially is going to be that it seems to be better for it to be a Jewish doctor than a non-Jewish doctor. Jack?
Could you not say that if it applies to a Goy, how much more so would it apply to a Jew?
So we'll come to that idea. You are correct, and we will see that idea. But that's where we are right now, is that indeed things are confusing. If you've reached the half hour point and you're not confused, I'm not doing my job. But I will take this opportunity again to tell people, because a lot of people came in after we started, the sign in sheets are over there. Please make sure that you sign in, especially if you want CME credit. But even if you just want follow up from this session or notice about future sessions here on medical ethics, make sure that you sign in. Okay. The confusion extends beyond the period of the Talmud itself. There are early authorities, Rashi and Tosfot, who I'm going to bring you now, specifically, who seem to say that indeed a fetus is not given the protections of a full life. One of them is Rashi. Take a look at source number 15. He says, the midwife, talking about the case of a fetus which is endangering the life of the mother. So Rashi writes, the midwife extends her arm, meaning inside the mother, and cuts it up and produces it in limbs. I'm sorry, it's gory. For as long as it has not emerged into the world, it is not a nefesh. Rashi doesn't give you the explanation the Rambam gave. Right? The Rambam said it's because it's endangering the mother. Makes it sound like it is a full life, it's just endangering the mother. Rashi doesn't say that. He says it's not a nefesh. Now, there's a lot of literature on the Rambam's abuse of the term rodef, calling it a pursuer, which we are not going to go into because literally there are more than a dozen different approaches to that Rambam, none of which will take us any closer to practical discussion of abortion. So I'm not going into the Rambam's use of the term rodef. What I'm bringing you here is that Rashi says, until the fetus emerges into the world, it is not a nefesh. Rabbi Moshe Tzuriel wrote an article in the 25th volume of Tchumen on this issue and thought that Rashi was based in a medrash called it's Mechilta to Shmo 21:12. Frankly, I think it was a misread of the Mechilta. It's not clear to me where Rashi is getting this from, except if you say it comes from the passage that we saw it's possible to make the argument that Rashi does have antecedents for this, but the point is, Rashi says it is not a nefesh at this stage. Yes. You took the line right out of my mouth. Thank you. You are 100% correct. Is the Gemara Nida Tazayin Amud Beis, which has a discussion about when the neshama enters the child, and indeed it's Jews versus Romans, as to whether it's in the beginning or after 40 days and such. However, Rabbi Tzuriel in that same article notes that nefesh and neshama are two different things, and there they're talking neshama, and maybe that has a different status from nefesh.
Why is that discussion in Nida? Isn't the point of Nida that there is no partnership?
Volumes of Talmud are not limited in any way, shape, or form to that which is in their name. You can discuss anything you like. The laws of selling a shul are in the Gemara and Megillah. Don't judge a book by its title. There is a similar source, which I did not bring on here. It's a Tosfot, in Nida, it's on Mem Daled, page 44, where he says, regarding a fetus, mutar lehargo, you are allowed to kill it. Assuredly, no one says that killing a fetus is simply mutar, is simply permissible. We already said that in the beginning, in that Rambam. So there's a lot of literature on what he means. But he definitely doesn't think of it as a full life, no matter how you read it. We know that killing the fetus is prohibited. So the question is, why is this prohibited if it's not considered to be a full life? What exactly is wrong? If we had more time, I would turn this into a question that I would ask you, and you would give me the answers. But in this case, I think I'm going to go through the sources with the answers, because there's so much we have to cover. So there are many different options. I am not listing every legal theory on this, just the ones that are discussed primarily, except for the first one I'm bringing, which isn't discussed by most people, but I bring it because I can't not. Source number 16, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein's article. He has a sentence which, when you read it, if you've read abortion-related halachic literature, you think, no one ever said this. And it's true, no one ever says this. He says, assuming that we set aside certain general ethical and religious norms, such as, you shall do that which is upright and good, right? You shall be holy, kedoshim tiyu, and you shall follow in the ways of God, v'alachta bidrachav. There would be, according to this view, no biblical prohibition to kill any fetus. He says, sure there's no biblical prohibition, unless you count, do that which is good, be holy, and so on. I never see anybody in halachic discussions regarding abortion mention these issues. Why is that?
They're too broad?
Well, they're very broad. Also because, while these are nice moral imperatives, they are, in the course of normal halacha, set aside in cases of need. And therefore, since what we're talking about here are cases of need, we're not discussing a frivolous decision, it tends not to really be on the table. But I think it should be remembered. I think it is still of significance. Okay, so let's get into the arguments that are brought. And here we get number 17, which Dr. Sandler has already anticipated. The Talmud here in Sanhedrin. Livnei Noach v'lo nishneis b'sinai li'yisrael nemra v'lo livnei Noach. Any mitzvah conveyed to Noachites and not repeated at Sinai applies to Jews, not Noachites. That sounds counterintuitive, no? Any mitzvah that is presented in the Torah before Mount Sinai and then it is not repeated to Jews afterwards applies to Jews alone. Example of this?
Brit Mila.
Brit Mila is repeated in Parshas Tazria. Sorry? Erev Menachai may be counted as later because we have a mitzvah of Shechita.
Puruvu.
Well, they have Lashabbos Yitzara. Chodesh Zalochem. That's a good one. Okay, unless you're going to say that counts from Tikru Saba Moadam. I was thinking of Gidanoshe. Right? Gidanoshe, not to eat from the sciatic neurovascular bundle. The that mitzvah is mentioned before and not mentioned after Sinai. And indeed, there's no concept that non-Jews are prohibited from eating the Gid HaNashe. So the Talmud, though, is bothered because this sounds very strange. I would think just the opposite. If it was not repeated at Sinai, then it's only for non-Jews. Right? That's what you should have said. And the Talmud's answer is nothing is permitted for Jews and prohibited for non-Jews. There's no way that a person can convert to Judaism and get out of a mitzvah. Right? That doesn't work. It's always going to be, you're always going to have more rules for a Jew. Now, I should note, not everybody agrees that we follow this principle in Pesach as a matter of halacha. Those who are interested should see the Lechem Mishnah in Hilchos Malachim Perek Tes, Halacha Yud Gimel, as well as Rabbi Tzuriel's article in the 25th volume of Tchumen. But even if we do accept this rule, it's not clear what it means. Meaning, I could take this rule as a statement that there is indeed I could take this rule to mean that there is a prohibition against abortion for Jews, just like we learned from the Talmud that there's a prohibition for non-Jews. Right? That's what I could come away with. But there are two different ways you can look at this rule. One way you could look at this rule is, this is the prohibition. In other words, why is it that I am not allowed to abort? Because non-Jews are not allowed to abort, therefore I must also not be allowed to abort. That's one way that you could read this source, and that sounds like what Rabbi Ben Sion Uziel said in source number 18. He says, in any case, it is clear that they, the sages, did not permit killing a fetus unless there is a need, even a weak need, like the mother's disgrace, right? The case of the executed mother. But without a need, it certainly is prohibited as destruction and prevention of the life of a soul in Israel. I'm going to come back to those points. But he says, and so wrote Tosfot, Jews may not kill fetuses, for nothing is prohibited for Noahites and permitted for Jews. So in other words, just because they are not allowed to do it, we're not allowed to do it. That's one way to look at it. However, I'll come back to you. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein says, and I think it's right, Aniyah Katan, that's not the way to read that line. He reads the line differently. Take a look at number 19. In other words, no action forbidden to a non-Jew of whom the Torah requires a less exacting moral standard can be permitted to the Jew. Hence, we must conclude that there must be some situations in which abortion is biblically proscribed. This indeed is the conclusion of most decisors. The question then remains, what is the specific prohibition? In other words, it's not that if it's usur for them, it's usur for us. That's not what it's saying. What it's saying is, if it's prohibited for them, then somewhere the Torah must have said that we're not allowed to do it. It must come under some existing biblical or some existing heading within Torah. The difference between the first approach and the second is that if the sole reason for prohibiting is source number 17, the rule that if it's usur for them, it's usur for us, maybe that rule is only a rabbinic rule. Maybe the rule that if it's prohibited for non-Jews, it's prohibited for Jews, is itself only a rabbinic rule. In which case, it can be overridden for a whole host of reasons. Whereas if I take the approach that Rabbi Lichtenstein seems to be presenting in number 19, that rule is only diagnostic. Right? That rule is saying there must be some prohibition, which is potentially a biblical prohibition. You follow? So it matters which way I read that line, Julie?
You answered it.
Okay. So what we have so far in our hunt for why abortion would be prohibited If it's not, if the fetus is not a full life, aside from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's points about general good behavior, you have a line in the Talmud that says, if non-Jews can't do it, we can't do it, which may be a rabbinic principle, which is itself the prohibition, may be a biblical rule, and may also just simply mean, look harder because there's something within Torah that prohibits it. Clear? Are we? Okay. So let's go through what that prohibition might be. Rabbi Yosef Moshe Trani, also known as the Maharit. Actually, sorry, before I get to him, Rabbi Uziel, who we just saw, right, in number 18, mentioned the possibility of prevention of the life of a soul in Israel. In other words, we have a mitzvah of procreation, and maybe what one does by aborting is one prevents procreation, right? Maybe that's what's wrong, that you have actually been mevatel, you prevented the production of a human life. It isn't one yet, but it was going to be. That's one argument. I'm going to be going in increasing order of severity in terms of what's involved. That's the lowest level of severity that one could entertain for a biblical law, simply because it's failure to follow through on a commandment. But let's say the parents already have children. They have fulfilled their basic obligation of procreation. Then this is less of a consideration. The next step up is one which Rabbi Uziel also mentioned. I translated it as destruction. But really what I want to say is, let me leave out Rabbi Uziel. I'm going to come back to him. But take a look at number 20. It's the better source. Rabbi Yosef ben Moshe Trani, also known as the Maharit. There's a problem when you read the Maharit on abortion. He has two responsa, which appear almost side by side. One is in volume 1, number 97. One is in volume 1, number 99. And the problem is that number 97, which is the one I'm quoting here, is dealing with a practical... I'm sorry, the former one, the one in 97, deals with a discussion of the Talmudic text. That's really what it is. It's a back and forth about how to read the Talmud. Number 99 is a practical question about a non-Jew who wants an abortion and whether a Jew is allowed to aid in the abortion. In the former source, the one that's more academic, he concludes to prohibit abortion, saying that he concludes to prohibit. In number 99, his conclusion is there's no loss of a nefesh, and therefore he is, in fact, more lenient. So the question is, what happened between 97 and 99? And there are all sorts of different approaches. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein says the ruling is in 97, and 99 was actually a mistake by a student. It wasn't from him at all. That's one extreme. There's another extreme that says 97 was one ruling, and in 99 he recanted. And then the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenberg, says actually 97, 98, and 99 are one long letter. And there, where the conclusion is what he has at the end of 99. That's not unusual. You find that in works of responsa, that single letters are often divided up into responsa by the publisher. It's not necessarily the decision even of the rabbi who wrote the responsum. Often they're published posthumously. So you don't know. Remember, you can see what I gave you here as biographical information. 16th to 17th century, this is centuries ago. And it's hard to really reconstruct what was going on. Well, look at this piece, because this is a key source in discussing what the prohibition might be. He quotes Tosfot, who said, although the person who kills the fetus is exempt regarding the abortion, it is not permitted. He's dealing with a Nafel case, a non-viable kid. This is because it is prohibited as an act of wounding. The problem is wounding. Let me ask you a question. Wounding whom?
Mother.
That's funny. I just heard two answers. Right? Fetus or mother. He didn't say. That's really important. We're going to have to come back to that. That is a critical distinction. But that's another possible explanation for why it would be prohibited. We move up the ladder of possible prohibitions with a Chavos Yair, Rabbi Yair Bachrach. And this is really the point I think the Rabbi Uziel was noting with destruction. Source number 21, Hebrew is the bottom of one side, English is the top of the next side. He says, certainly we may not cause his death, the death of a fetus, for this would certainly be prohibited ab initio lechatchila. It is no better than destroying seed. And here I ellipsize the passage of his, and he notes, based on a comment of Tosfot, that the prohibition against destroying seed applies not only for males, but also for women, and then he has a discussion of whether that's really true. But the point is, the destruction of seed. We are not the Catholic Church on this issue. Nonetheless, the fact of the matter is that we have a serious prohibition, going back to the story of Aaron Onan and Yehuda and Tamar. We have a prohibition against destroying seed without purpose. We discussed it a little bit, I think, when we had the class on IVF. I think at that point we had more of a discussion of it. But this would also be a prohibition, because as he says, if I'm not allowed to destroy seed, how in the world would I ever be permitted to destroy that which the seed has produced, which is already on the way? So that's another argument. And then we get to the most severe. And the most severe is Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's position. It is not only his position. It is the position of Rabbi Yisro Yehuda Unterman, past chief rabbi of the State of Israel, Rabbi Menashe Klein, the Mishnah Halachos, Rabbi Shmuel Wasner in Israel, the Shevet Halevi, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau probably. It's a very serious position. We always quote it with Rabbi Moshe Feinstein because he was the one who was most vocal on this issue. And he says, take a look at source number 22, it is even more clear in the Rambam that killing a fetus is murder. For he based the permission to cut a fetus to save a mother on the fetus's status as a pursuer attempting to kill her. Right? Go back to that Rambam. The fact that he said you can kill the fetus to save the mother because it is pursuing the mother indicates that he thinks it's really a life. And all the sources we brought that indicate that it's not a full life, Rabbi Feinstein does away with them one by one. And he makes that argument that it's actually murder. So what we have at this stage, actually, sorry, one more source before we get to at this stage, source number 23, where Aaron Lichtenstein finds this approach compelling. He says, as noted, I definitely favor adopting the first possibility, meaning the possibility that this is murder or quasi-murder, based on the proof text regarding the Noahide, right? The text that we read regarding the non-Jew doing this said, one who spills the blood of man in man, the text was a murder text. It was about murder. So he says, that indicates to me that that's what this is. And he quotes you a Medrash, a Mechilta, which supports it. Indeed, the Mechilta records the position of Isi ben Akiva that whatever is forbidden a Noachide because of the prohibition of murder is likely forbidden to the Jew, and the text talks about shedding blood. After his quote of the Mechilta, he says, though the punishment of the Jew in certain types of homicide may be lighter, the fact that he has violated the prohibition of homicide, it does not vary. Therefore, it seems clear that in any case where a Noachide abortionist is liable for murder, a Jew is considered a murderer as well. That's his position. Yes?
So how do you deal with the Gemara with women who's liable for capital punishment if they kill the baby?
Right. So the argument there will be that the fetus is considered part of the mother, and therefore just like the mother receives the sentence, so the fetus receives the sentence.
The fetus didn't do anything. It doesn't have autonomy. It just kind of floats around.
That's exactly his point. It doesn't have autonomy. It's just another limb.
But that's contradicting this. We're saying you're killing it, it's killing it.
Right. It seems to be proposing a legal theory in which something can be considered a nefesh and yet be considered part of something else, which is difficult to grasp. Yes. Yes. I'm not defending any side on this because this is way, way beyond my grade. But yes, there are difficulties with his read. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who we're going to be talking about quite a bit shortly, came out with the premier responsum permitting abortion of a Tay-Sachs fetus up to the seventh month. And Rabbi Feinstein came out against him with guns blazing. Seriously, calling him Chacham Echad, a certain sage has said this, and blasting him for his position. And then Rabbi Waldenberg came back, and Rabbi Dr. Steinberg likes to talk about this, how he was putting out a book on medicine and halacha, and Rabbi Waldenberg told him he wanted to put that in on this issue. He wanted to put his rejoinder to Rabbi Feinstein as the introduction to the book. It's really, I mean, this is, I hesitate to say things that make people laugh because it's such a painful issue, and I don't mean to in any way be glib about what we're talking about. These are the gravest of issues. But the back and forth between them illustrates the strong emotions that are involved, as well as the challenge of just reading the text. Go back to what Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein said in the second source. It's just not clear. I know that I'm not allowed to do this, but I don't have a clear picture of why. And the why affects when it is permitted. So we have a real problem, and you have to have a derech. You have to have somebody who you follow and just say, this is the view that we take. And that brings me to the last part of this question of how we view abortion before we can apply it to our cases. But right now, what we have is unclear biblical text, unclear Talmudic text, and then a range of views ranging from you shall be holy all the way through it's murder to explain why one is not permitted to abort. So depending on which reason one adopts for the prohibition, that determines which needs would justify abortion. And at what stage in the pregnancy one could abort. If you take the view that it's murder, we're now going to work the other way around, starting from the most severe and working our way down. So if you take the view that it is murder, there's only one justification, and that is saving the life of the mother. Right? That's going to be the only case in which it will be allowed, and you require a level of certainty, according to Rabbi Feinstein. There's a classic debate. When the Torah says that if someone is pursuing another party to kill him, we talked about this in the class on treating a terrorist and medical care for terrorists, if A is pursuing B to kill him, and so I'm justified in stopping A at whatever cost, right? That rule. So the question is, how sure do I have to be that A is trying to kill B? Rabbi Feinstein is of the view, as he articulates in the abortion discussion in source number 22, that you need certainty. He says killing a fetus is prohibited until the doctors have great reason, close to certainty, that the mother will die. Now, not everybody agrees with him on the rule of safek rodef, on the question of how certain you need to be. Not everybody agrees, but that's his stance. How early in the pregnancy will it be prohibited? Certainly from day 40. According to Rabbi Unterman, even before day 40, Rabbi Yehuda Unterman, the former chief rabbi of the state of Israel, felt even within the 40 days. There's another possibility within the murder realm, and that is that it's quasi-murder, what we call abizrayu, something which is murder-like, but not quite murder because it's not a viable life out there in the world yet. It's still a fetus. And according to that view, says Rabbi Lichtenstein in source number 25, he actually applies two different things, so I'm going to hold his source. What I brought you in 25 deals with both the possibility that it is quasi-murder or the possibility that it is destruction of seed. So now let's read it with both of those in mind. He says, if abortion is literally a case of hashchatat zera, destruction of seed, and not merely analogous to that category, the prohibition obviously would come into play from the first moment. Right? You follow what he says? Right? It makes sense. If the prohibition is wasting seed, then it's from the beginning when it's a seed. If, however, we assume that the specific prohibition on hashchatat zera does not apply in this case, such as if we take the view of the Chazon Ish, that it's not the mother's problem, it only is at the moment of production of the seed, then we are dealing with a distinct prohibition, which is an appurtenance to murder. Appurtenance to murder, for those who don't follow his English, is this quasi-murder category. Then it will be possible to divide the period of pregnancy halachically. The most reasonable measure is, of course, the 40-day mark, which we already said is the cutoff where it's no longer considered to be just water. So Rabbi Lichtenstein suggests that if you take the view that it is quasi-murder, then it is after 40 days. After 40 days or immediate, I should say. There is the possibility to make it immediate, but after 40 days would be reasonable. What would justify it? So Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau and others say it would still have to be threat to the mother's health. If you adopt the view, though, that it's about wasting seed, it's not necessarily wasting. right? We discussed this when we talked about IVF. Production of seed that will not lead to a human life walking around extra utero, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's been wasted. So the there may be justifications, as there are in fact justifications in the Gemara itself. Rabbi Lichtenstein notes it in source number 26. He says, here it is clear that saving a life is not the only sanction for permitting an abortion. This is evident from the Talmudic passage that permits a nursing mother to cohabitate using a moch. A moch is a barrier to prevent pregnancy. Since this prohibition is waived to facilitate normal family relations, which is why the omission in this context is not wasteful, it would follow that other ethical and humane factors may also be taken into account. Let me explain that a little bit better. The Talmud talks about three cases in which we don't want a woman to become pregnant. One case, for example, is if she is nursing a child, and the concern is that if she becomes pregnant, she will no longer produce milk, and the child she is nursing will die. That's an example of it. Leave aside the medicine of it, it's not the point. But the Talmud then says she is allowed to be with her husband and simply use a moch, use a barrier. Now, that means the seed is not going to produce a child. Why are you allowing this? Why not just say, be celibate? And the answer is, because that's not something we're going to impose upon this couple. So producing this seed is not called wasteful, it's part of normal life. Well, that tells me that there are cases in which it's not called wasteful, even if it's not going to produce a full-blown life. And so he writes, at the end of this source 26, it would seem to me that issues such as kavod habriyot, human dignity, shalom bayis, domestic peace, tsar, pain, which all carry significant halachic weight in other contexts, should be considered in making these decisions. So you see, your reason for not aborting, your halachic reason for not aborting, matters. If the issue is murder, there's very little that can justify the abortion. If your issue is wasting seed, there is much more room for justification. What if you adopt the view that it's about wounding? Well, it depends who you're wounding. The general rule is that you are allowed to wound someone if it is for their benefit. Right? You're allowed to amputate a limb for somebody if it's for their benefit. So, let's say we're talking about wounding the fetus. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, source number 27, says, it is also possible to say that when Tosfot says one may not, that says one may kill the fetus, that line that I quoted before, mutar lehargo, he means one is not liable at all under the law of murder, but Tosfot agrees it is prohibited as destruction, and therefore one, I should have written wounding rather than destruction, I was writing too quickly. And therefore, one may not kill it without another human need. But if there is a human need, then it will indeed be acceptable. Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli in Amud Hayimini, Lamed Beis, also has room for leniency. And when will the prohibition apply if this is indeed wounding? So Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sridei Eish, who takes this view, discusses a case of rubella, where the mother has rubella and therefore the child is likely to develop problems, serious problems, and he suggests, based on that Maharit about wounding, that it's 40 days that this begins. Before 40 days, there is no issue of wounding, and then after 40 days, you would need the justification for wounding, that it is in the best interests of the fetus. Julie?
Well, there's a difference between rubella, a child who had rubella.
Yeah, I'm not going to do specifics of rubella. It's a good question, but I don't have the time to. There were a lot of cases that I saw responsive for. Rubella, Down syndrome discussions, illegitimate children from adultery, all sorts of stuff that I don't have the time to go into here. I apologize. If you want, we can discuss it after. What if the view is that it's about wounding the mother? Then Rav Aaron Lichtenstein in source number 29 says that the prohibition of wounding the mother may begin at day 40, but it may begin at 3 months. What happens at 3 months? What's the change at 3 months? That's when you can first tell, as far as the Talmud is concerned, that a woman is pregnant. That by looking at her, you will see her as a mother. And therefore, by killing the fetus, I am wounding her person because she looked like a mother, and now I'm taking that status from her. So he argues it might be at 3 months that would begin. And again, if you hold the issue as wounding the mother, if it's for her benefit, then even after then you may have the argument that that even afterwards it may be permitted. Finally, there is a view that the whole thing is rabbinic. Go back to that rule. Right? The rule that says that there's nothing that is permitted for Jews and prohibited for non-Jews. If you assume that that's the rule that creates the prohibition, and that that rule is itself a rabbinic rule, we have various leniencies to justify violating rabbinic prohibitions. Yabia Omer, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, in source number 30, dealt with this. He dealt with a case in 1963 where doctors said that it was dangerous for a mother to carry a child to term. And he made the argument that that one would be lenient until the three-month mark. That would be the idea. So we have here a set of possibilities. We haven't decided anything. We have a set of possibilities. Let's try to apply them to actual cases. We need to go further with this. Okay, so the first vignette is the Tay-Sachs one, which is sort of the classic within the modern halachic abortion literature. We have 25 minutes to go for the hour and a half. I expect to get through the four cases. I'm going to do the best that I can with it. I may need to cut questions at some point. Okay, so the first point to recognize when we're dealing with the Tay-Sachs issue is that there is a range of opinion regarding trusting doctors' predictions themselves. And the reason why there is a range of opinion is, first of all, because not everybody views fetal life the same way. We live in an age in which there are many people who say that it's an offense to the mother, and not just like offense, like it's offensive, but you're harming the mother by telling her that she has to continue with a pregnancy that will cause her pain or that she doesn't wish to continue with. And the argument is that the doctor may have an agenda or not take your concern seriously. And that's the concern that's mentioned in some quarters. Another reason, though, is simply that doctors aren't always right. And they know it. There is such a thing as margin of error. Every medical professional is aware of it. And therefore, when a prediction is made on the basis of 75% certainty, 80% certainty, even 95% certainty, it may not come true. Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, in his article in source number 31, gives you a story about a woman who waited for years, finally became pregnant, was told in an exam that the fetus had not made it, that the fetus was dead. And they were going to clean her out, that she's in the hospital waiting for the procedure when she sees a doctor in the unit who knew her from when she had been trying to get pregnant. The doctor sees her, asks her what's going on. She tells him the story. He wants to do another exam. The exam determines that the fetus is indeed alive. And she recently celebrated her bat mitzvah. That's the story that he tells in source number 31. So, look, horror stories like that don't prove anything. Because everybody knows that there are margins of error. Everybody knows there are mistakes. But the question is, if we're talking about potentially aborting, these are high stakes. At what point can you trust? And the answer seems to be that by and large, we are trusting, but there's a range of views as to what the level of certainty is that we require. Moshe Tsuriel, in the article I've mentioned before from Tchumen 25, I brought it in source number 32, says, our doctors are good, our medical knowledge is good, it's close to certain, and therefore he quotes you a rule from Rabbi Moshe Isserles in the Shulchan Aruch, in the 16th century, who was not willing to trust doctors on a particular issue, and he says, yeah, because that was the 16th century. He says, we're not like that anymore. He's actually pretty confident in the doctors. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, that Tzitz Eliezer, says he wants chashash mevusas in source 33. He says he wants to see that you have a substantiated concern. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein says you can't go running around to get the best doctor in the world. Doesn't work that way. He says, even though he's very strict regarding abortion, and we know that he wants you to be near certain, right, as close to certain as you can be, nonetheless, he says, source 34, we only have the doctor in our day and place when we cannot access a more expert doctor. You work with who you have. And Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, in source number 35, that's from something else. That's not what I wanted here, I think. Yeah, no, I see what I did. Okay. Generally speaking, we work with what we have. But the basic rule is going to be, the closer you are to thinking this is murder, the more likely you are to not trust whatever report it is that the doctor is giving you, because the stakes are higher. So, what do you do in the Tay-Sachs case? So you have two extremes. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's position is, as I said, one may not abort. And the Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, quotes Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach, taking that position. Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, this is the one in 35, was dealing not with a Tay-Sachs case, but a rubella case. And he was almost ready. He writes in his responsum, it is possible to be lenient, to rely on the view of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who indeed was lenient regarding abortion. And then there's a footnote in his published responsum, in which he writes, what you see here in 35, that he saw the article by Rabbi Isser Yehuda Unterman, who prohibits aborting a fetus even before 40 days. And therefore, he says, you still have to take counsel. He backs down from his permissive ruling. He says, I'm not willing to permit. Then you have the other extreme. And the other extreme says, no, this is a rabbinic issue, and therefore the whole prohibition is viewed as potentially rabbinic, and therefore one may abort even relatively late. I brought you source number 36, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, with a text, part of the text of his initial permission. Actually, this isn't his first response on it, but one of his response of permitting abortion in the case of the Tay-Sachs. And he says, it is clear and obvious as law that a Jew is not killed for a fetus, meaning for abortion. Aside from one view, the authorities rule there is a prohibition, but many authorities believe the prohibition is rabbinic or it is under, quote, building the world. But there is no concern, meaning that you're preventing the building of the world. But there is no concern for destroying a life. And so he goes through this and he also notes the permission in a case of great need, and he says, the last paragraph I translated in 36, ask yourself, is there any need, pain, or ache greater than in our case, which will cause the mother in birthing such a creation whose whole existence is suffering and pain and whose death is certain in a matter of years and whose parents watch and deteriorate without any power to save? And certainly, he says, it would not change or reduce anything if the child would be taken to a special institution without access for the parents until his death. And added to this are the suffering and pain of the child himself. And suffering and emotional pain in great measure are greater and more painful than physical pain. He is not willing to have the parents go through it. He believes that this is justification for abortion. That's the position that he takes. Now, I deliberately gave you in the vignette, which I forgot to read out loud, that this is with a diagnosis at 11 weeks. He actually went up to 7 months. Why 7 months? Because the fetus, sorry?
It's viable.
Because the fetus is viable at that point. In modern medicine, the fetus will be considered viable. Yes?
In modern medicine, the fetus is viable even at 5 or 6 months.
Correct. He's writing this decades ago, in the 1970s. And indeed, the goalposts will shift. Now, I should note, though, viable doesn't mean viable with a NICU. Viable with a NICU is not viable right now. I mean viable meaning it could come out and feasibly function. Even if it will be, it's a preemie and will have certain challenges potentially because it didn't get special care, that's what we're talking about. And yes, the goalposts will move in terms of defining viability. But that's the position of Rabbi Waldenberg. Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli, as well, in source number 37, takes that position and says that he says one should add that it is appropriate to consider as well the pain of the parents, seeing the fruit of their womb enduring suffering, and their lives are not lives. It is no less than the pain of delaying a sentence and the posthumous degradation of the mother, which also led to permitting killing the fetus. He says, if you could permit that, you permit this. Now, again, there were responses in that case to say that it was because the fetus was going to die anyway when the mother was executed, so what's the difference if it's earlier? There were justifications there. But he also was willing to permit. His case was not a Tay-Sachs case, it was a different deformity, I forget which. But the point is that in the Tay-Sachs case, you find one extreme, Rabbi Feinstein, who says this is murder, and therefore the pain and the suffering of the child and the parents do not figure. And the opposite extreme, Rabbi Waldenberg, Rabbi Yisraeli, who are willing to permit, and they consider not only the situation of the child, but also the pain of the parents as part of their calculation. No one in this conversation takes this lightly. I want to be very clear about this. Rabbi Waldenberg, Rabbi Israeli are not saying, sure, go ahead, this is fine. They're viewing it as the least bad option of a set of bad options. That's what they're talking about. Okay. Second case. Second case is the case of emotional health. And the emotional health of the mother. So as I articulated it in the beginning, in source number 4, this woman who was 33 has birthed 3 children. With the birth of her third child, she experienced moderate to severe postpartum depression, including suicidal ideation, for which she was treated with medication and counseling for the first year after birth. Unexpectedly, she finds that she is 5 weeks pregnant. May she pursue an abortion? So, we have precedent in halacha for taking emotional health very, very seriously. We consider depression grounds for violating Shabbos. That includes acting prophylactically for someone who is at risk to develop it. I brought you a line from Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein that appeared in the journal Osseo, where he quoted Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik. It's source number 38. English is on the top of the next slide. Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav, told a doctor that saving a life is not specifically the case of someone who is now dangerously ill and will die. He's talking about fasting on Yom Kippur. And he says, even where the fast will affect him years later, when the disease will recur, and so fasting now will cause him to die early, this is saving a life, and he is required to eat. And I bring that here because that's what we're potentially talking about. The article of Rabbi Zilberstein is talking about treating depression as pikuach nefesh, as a life-threatening situation. You're talking about a woman who right now isn't experiencing the postpartum depression, but will be after giving birth, we fear will be. That's safek pikuach nefesh. It is about potentially saving a life. At the same time, if we take the view of Rabbi Feinstein that abortion is murder or quasi-murder, then there is a very high standard to meet, higher standard than violating Shabbos. Generally speaking, we require that she actually be at risk for suicide, for taking her own life. Simply the fact that she may be experiencing depression in and of itself is not sufficient. If you take a look at source 39, Rabbi Yisro Yehuda Unterman makes that point. The laundry discussion is a Gemara and a Darim, which I'm going to skip for right now. The point is that he views, in general, shiamum, shigaon, irrationality, as not inherently being loss of life. It's only if it risks something else that you would consider it a danger to life. That leads Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham to make the point that he makes in source number 40. He says, the non-observant head of a psychiatric department told me that he never recommends abortion for such a woman who is at risk for serious postpartum depression. For she can be treated with pills. And in the great majority of cases, the force of depression and irrationality after birth can be prevented. And so a leading psychiatrist has told me, now keep in mind, he was the head of internal medicine for decades at Shari Tzedek Hospital. He's not someone who's talking without medical knowledge. Based on this, it appears that there is no permission to conduct abortion for a woman like this, and Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rabbi Yehoshua Neuwirth agreed with me. However, I hasten to add source number 41. Source number 41, Rabbi Eliezer Melamed writes the following. But it is clear that where there is emotional illness which cannot be treated with medicine and is caused by the pregnancy, then since emotional illness is generally considered a threat to life, she may abort her fetus to protect her life. And I say that because, unfortunately, it isn't true that just because there are antidepressant pills, they're going to work in all cases, you'll be able to calibrate it's very patient dependent. And so this shouldn't be taken as simply, well, there's medicine, and therefore don't take the emotional health into consideration. It's simply not so. There is another concern, of course, within this, that if you're going to justify the abortion for emotional health, then what about other lesser forms of threats to emotional health? And so Rabbi Wozner, in source number 42, is worried about where things will go if we permit for this. But the basic principle is, yes, the emotional health matters. Yes, this potential severe depression is very significant. What about the Plan B pill? That's where our case number three. So as I framed it on the sheet, medical literature claims the Plan B pill, if taken within 72 hours of sexual relations, prevents conception. I gave you the literature, or quote from the literature, on this pill in source number 43, which again makes the argument that it inhibits fertilization. That's really the key argument. It's supposed to not be an issue of abortion, although they do note that it has contraceptive effects going forward, but it's in terms of not conceiving, not in terms of ending the existence of a fetus. So going back to the vignette, Susan has been using a diaphragm for sexual relations on rabbinic recommendation. She is following the guidance of the rabbi due to concerns for her emotional health. But one time she forgets to use it. May she use the Plan B pill. If it is after 72 hours, may she take RU486, the abortion pill. That's the question. So there is a view that suggests that if she becomes pregnant because of her own carelessness, we would not kill the fetus to save her. However, as brought in Rabbi Dr. Abraham's Nishmas Avram, we don't rule that way. You're not going to say, well, if it was her fault, therefore we're going to make this go to term. We have a hierarchy of methods. First of all, Rabbi Melamed notes that it might be better for a Jew to administer, just as a general note. We mentioned it before, but I didn't come back to it in the course of the class. In general, it may be better for a Jew to abort than for a non-Jew to do so, where it's permitted at all. That's number one. But more to the point here, it is generally considered to be better to abort with a pill, with a medication, as opposed to aborting with surgery. Rabbi Melamed makes this point in source number 44, because it's considered an indirect abortion, and the Plan B approach would be better. Rabbi Melamed makes this point in source number 45, where he notes that the pill is preventing conception, and on that basis he recommends it in a case of a woman who was raped. He says that that absolutely she should use this pill. Last case, the issue of aiding during a prohibited abortion. And the case I gave was the case of the anesthesiologist who has to provide IV sedation during the abortion. So there are two halachic concerns. One concern is lifnei iver, not to put a stumbling block in front of the blind, as I noted in source number 46. And you see in source number 47, you're not allowed to give someone inappropriate advice. You cannot lead somebody to do something they're not supposed to do. The second concern is misayea. This is a concern which is generally assumed to be rabbinic. Lifnei iver, not putting a stumbling block, is biblical. This is a rabbinic concern of not aiding somebody in doing something that is inappropriate, doing something that the Torah prohibits. Whether it's a function of the prohibition against putting a stumbling block in front of the blind, whether it's because we're supposed to keep people from sinning, whether it's because we are all responsible for each other, the Ritva's argument in source number 49, I'm not supposed to help people sin. So where you're talking about an abortion which the Torah does not justify, none of the different arguments that were made before to potentially justify an abortion applies. Under the view that, well, I don't want to go into it. Create your own case where the Torah would not allow it. You are now the anesthesiologist who's being asked to help. You have a problem of lifnei iver. You have a problem of misayeya, of assisting. What do you do? So, the general book on lifnei iver, on not causing people to stumble, says that in the event that they could get this help from somebody else, and the help would be of the same quality as your own, and at the same cost as what you would provide, then the general rule is that it's not called a violation of lifnei iver. It's based on the Talmud in source number 50, which I'm not going to go into right now, but source number 51, Rabbi Moshe Isserles codifies it in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. He says, some say he's dealing with a prohibition against selling non-Jews items related to idolatry, because they're not supposed to be worshipping idols. So he says, some say the prohibition against selling them idolatry-related items applies only where they lack similar items and they couldn't purchase them elsewhere. If they can purchase elsewhere, one may sell them anything. And then he says some are strict, but the practice is to be lenient following the first view. A person of spirit will be strict for himself. So the argument will be, if you don't do it, they'll get another anesthesiologist. So it won't be you. There are others who disagree because here you are helping during the act itself, and they feel that this is still a lifnei iver problem. There's a Rashi, which is the basis for making that argument in source number 52. But nonetheless, Rabbi Waldenberg dealt with this as a practical question, and he ruled to permit. He was actually dealing not with the ultrasound case. Sorry, he was dealing with the. He was not dealing with anesthesia. He was dealing with an ultrasound before the abortion, and he approved the case where the doctor, where the technician needed to be the one to do it. What about the concern for Miseyeya, where you're actually helping with the procedure? So Rabbi Waldenberg, again, is not dealing with the case of anesthesia. He's dealing with the case of the ultrasound, and he says what you're doing is simply providing a background step, and you're not aiding in the act itself. And on that basis, he's lenient in that case. A second argument for leniency is based on the Shach in source number 54. And that's the argument that if you're dealing with a mumar, somebody who rejects Torah law anyway, then maybe there's no prohibition against assisting them in it. Rabbi Waldenberg is lenient as well on this issue. And then Rabbi Usher Weiss, in an audio lecture which I linked for you in source number 55, and again, if you didn't sign up, if you didn't register yet, whatever, sign in, that's the word I wanted. If you didn't sign in yet, please make sure before leaving that you do sign in, because I'm going to be sending out the source sheets digitally as well, and the link will be active, so you can click on that link instead of having to retype it. There, in that lecture, he talks about the anesthesiologist, and he says the anesthesiologist is just doing his job of providing anesthesia, and that is considered to be acceptable, even though that enables the abortion, and it's in fact going on during the abortion. I should know, Rabbi Usher Weiss is generally of the belief that it's very, very important to have observant Jewish doctors. And he doesn't want a situation in which observant Jews will not be able to practice medicine. And that colors, in general, and he says so, it colors his perspective on issues where the question is, participate or you can't practice medicine. This comes up in other discussions of his as well.
Yeah, but it doesn't talk at all about the emotional impact on the practitioner.
No.
He says nothing about it. It's the end of his lecture. He's talking about a whole bunch of other issues first.
Yes. That is correct. He does not talk about the impact on the practitioner. He's dealing with the question of the practitioner says to him, can I do this? But you are right. He's not addressing that at all. I should note that there are those who say even if you solve Miseyeya and Lifnei Iver, assisting and putting the stumbling block, even if you solve those, since your role is so direct, they are not comfortable with it. I brought you a case in source number 56 about converting somebody to Judaism when you know they're not going to observe mitzvot. And even if they can get the conversion somewhere else, nonetheless, you're not really helping them, and it's considered to be putting a stumbling block in their way, as noted by Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook in source number 56. The upshot of what we've said, and I can't possibly summarize an hour and 26 minutes in 2.5, but the summary of what we've said is the text in the Torah is not clear about how we view the life of the fetus. There are sources like the one about the men who strike the pregnant woman, which sounds like it's not considered a full-blown life. The passages in the Mishnah, in the Talmud, they also seem to go both ways. And you can make arguments about how to read each one to discount each of the texts that we have there. That leads to a range of views. We know it's prohibited. We know that no authority in traditional Jewish law is going to prohibit an abortion simply because I want one. It will need some level of justification. The only question is what the level of justification required is. If it's murder, like Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and the others who are with him say, it has to be a danger to the life of the mother. You're talking about physical danger to the life of the mother or danger for suicide, like that level of need. If you say that it is a matter of wounding the fetus, then if this is considered to be in the fetus's best interest, then you would be allowed to go forward. If it's wounding the mother, then again, if it's in the mother's best interest to do it, it would then be justified. If it's a matter of wasting seed, then then you would need there to be some purpose to it such that it's not waste. In each case, there is a justification, and again, only up to a certain point within the pregnancy will you be able to justify, and then after that, you're going to say, it's called a life, now we have a higher threshold that you need. I close with a note from Rabbi Lichtenstein in source number 57. It's a note that he makes at the end of his article. He, again, took the view, like Rabbi Feinstein, that this is either murder or quasi-murder. And he says something which you all know, you've heard before, but I think at the end of this talk it bears repeating. He says, but it is worth making clear, certainly to those who, in seeking a humane approach, are liable to adopt slavishly an overly liberal attitude in this area, that from the perspective of the fetus and those concerned with its welfare, liberality in this direction comes at the expense of humanity, insofar as the caution of the halacha is tied to its intimate concern for the values of kindness and mercy. It is not only the honor of God which obligates us, regardless of the cost, to avoid what is prohibited and to obey the commands of the Holy One, blessed be He, that are expressed in this halacha. It is also the honor of man in halacha, the humane and ethical element which insists on the preservation of human dignity and concern for human welfare, that rises up in indignation against the torrent of abortions. If the halacha's course is sometimes onerous for certain families or for those responsible for them, and this fact should neither be denied nor ignored, let us remember, paraphrasing the famous words of Byron, that halacha loved not the parents less, but the child more. Thank you so much for participating. Thank you again to the Bayit for making this possible. I realize that I basically monologued the last half hour or so. If people have questions, items to discuss, please come to me. I will stay. And please make sure to sign in. There are two sign-in sheets over here. Where is the third? Where's the third one? Thank you very much.